Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Hugh Prevost. I am on staff here at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. And it is my privilege this evening to welcome you to the 13th annual C.S. Lewis Lectureship. A very brief commercial. The lectureship this year is sponsored by several groups from the Chattanooga area, from the Chattanooga Christian Community Foundation, the Benwood Foundation, and the Speakers and Special Events Committee of the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. I know that you didn't come to hear or see me. I will try to be as brief as possible, but I would like for you to know a little bit about our speaker. I will not bore you with Dr. Pestinus' academic pedigree, though I think you should know that she is president and professor of Christian spirituality at Eastern College in St. David's, Pennsylvania, a suburb of Philadelphia. Or do you really want to hear a long list of her books, which she has several, or the number of boards that she served on? But I think that you probably should know that she has chaired the board of directors of the World Vision International and still remains quite active on that board. And as a matter of fact, we were talking, and she is heading to Vienna, Austria, sometime soon to initiate a new board over there. You came for the main event, and so let me just do a brief moment to sort of challenge you. And I'd like to use the words of one of her former students maybe to do that by. I can think of really no greater praise. As you know, the university sort of in the downside of a semester, and so the grades and things are important. I can think of no greater praise maybe than a former student who's not in the grade hunt to sort of talk about a former teacher. Mark Golly, a student of Dr. Hestinus and at the Fuller Theological Seminary, wrote an introduction to one of her co-authored books, Mastering Teaching, says this of his former professor and of her commitment to teaching, but not only to teaching, but to teaching the great commandment, Christ's great commandment. He says this about her: because she gets people to ask themselves the most important questions, Hestinus makes a difference in whatever setting she's in, whether as a Bible teacher, as a professor, or as a college president. In each setting, she has gotten people to think, to ponder, and eventually to do more for their Lord. I challenge you. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Roberta Hestinus, professor, college president, minister.
Thank you. This lectureship is for me a great privilege because of two things. One, it's my first visit to Chattanooga and to the university, and it's been a joy to be here and to learn about this place and this school and the things that are part of the life here. And the second is because of the person in whose honor this lectureship is named, C.S. Lewis, who, along with thousands, yea, millions of other people, I claim through his writings as one of my teachers and mentors, a man whose books I began collecting early after my own conversion experience in college, and whose has been an extremely important formative influence on my own life. One of the joys of my life right now are my three grown children, one of whom is busily working his way through the corpus of C.S. Lewis's writings. And it's such a joy when you love something to have someone who is very close to you read it for the first time and to see them also learn and respond and be deepened and strengthened by that reading. So I am very honored to be here on this particular occasion. Let me set a bit of a context for you for the topic tonight, which is spirituality and public discipleship in a pluralistic society, by telling you a true story. A summer ago, I was spending several months in China, and I was at one point in that visit in the deep interior of China, where there had been 100 years flood with loss of life and enormous damage and difficulty for the people in that place. And the government had asked World Vision International, which is a Christian relief and humanitarian agency that works in 100 countries, the Chinese government had openly asked us for the first time since the communists came to power in China if we would come and help them in the relief and rebuilding effort in this province in China. And I was told when I was met by the Communist Party chief that I was the first American that had been in that particular province in 50 years, the first outside visitor that they had allowed to move freely in that province. And it was the need was devastating and heartbreaking, and the opportunity to be in that place was a wonderful privilege to be there as I went from place to place to see where Christians working with World Vision had helped local people to relocate and rebuild homes, to work with minority peoples to get another shot at a meaningful life with some dignity in it, to work with some of the problems that are endemic and very, very difficult because of the high level of poverty and insufficiency in that particular area. Well, a standard thing when you do this kind of a trip is that when the Communist Party people are your hosts, that you get up early in the morning every day. I love Chinese food, but for breakfast, lunch and dinner, and company for breakfast, as we ate our rice in the morning and our rice at noon and our rice in the evening. And we would go to a difficult place, and we would see the poverty, and we'd see the need. And in some of the places, we'd talk about what should be done. In some of the places, we could see work that had already begun. And in a few places, we could see work that had actually come to some kind of completion. The days were about 18 hours long. And in this particular province, the roads are designed so that you go up the side of a mountain in switchbacks for 6,000 feet, and then down the side of the mountain into the village at the bottom, and then up the next mountain and down that particular mountain on roads that most of us would consider trails rather than true roads. One Sunday, after several weeks of this intensity of traveling and visiting and bouncing and all of that, I found myself sitting in the back of a Land Rover, actually a Jeep, and the Communist Party hosts were sitting with me. One translator was in the Jeep, and there was a little caravan, which was typical of three or four, and I found myself praying, and the prayer was something like this: Lord, it's Sunday. And I know that today, at home, my husband's in church. I know that all over the world today, Christians are gathering in the name of Jesus to worship. And Lord, I'm lonely. I would like some Christian fellowship, but I don't see how under these circumstances. I don't see any way, but Lord, here I am. And we bounced down the road several hours to the place where we were going. And an astonishing thing happened after we visited this village and saw the little school that was being built, the new crops that were being planted, the mud houses that were being reestablished a little higher up so the floods wouldn't get them the next time. The communist chief came to me and he said, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And I said, why? He said, because we have an extra hour. And for weeks, every minute of 18-hour days had been planned for me. And my immediate reaction was, an extra hour? This is wonderful. But he was sorry. And he said, is there anything you'd like to do? He said, perhaps He has heard a lot about Americans. Perhaps, he said to me, you'd like to go shopping? Now, I'm in the middle of rural China. There is nothing to shop for. And that wasn't what was on my mind. And I said to him, we really have a free hour? Yes. And he couldn't take me back to the provincial center. We weren't supposed to be there until exactly the right time. And I said, would it be possible for me to visit the church that I glimpsed from the side of the road as we were coming to this place? He said, what church? There is no church. And I said, well, I probably am wrong. I'm probably mistaken, but I think I saw a cross back away from the road. And he said, no, your eyes deceived you. You didn't see a cross. And I said, well, if it should happen, are we going back the same way? Yes. If it should happen that I should see that cross, could we stop in that place for a moment or two, since we have this hour that you don't know what to do with? All right, he said, reluctantly. So we pile back into the convoy, and I'm thinking, Lord, may it not have been a delusion. May have not seen a hallucination. Help me to see that again. So we speed along the road, and I look out midway in the journey, and I see it. There's a cross. And I yell, stop! And the driver screeches, and the next driver screeches, and the next driver screeches, and we pile out. And while they had their cigarettes and stood by the road, the translator and I walked through muddy rice paddies and found a little path that took us over a bridge, over a small stream, into a very tiny village and up a little hill, heading toward the cross that we had seen. And when we got there, a woman who was crippled came walking out somewhat rapidly. You could hear the buzz starting to come up in the village at these outsiders. They obviously didn't have visitors. And the woman came and she introduced herself, and she was a deacon in the church. Oh, yes, we have a church. We worship on Sunday, but we cannot worship until after we have done all our work in the fields. We finished all the tasks that we have to do, so we come at the end of the day in order to gather for worship. How many come for worship here in this place that time has forgotten, in this back of beyond? Well, she said, on a bad Sunday, about 500. All right. Could I meet the pastor? Is it possible to meet the pastor of the church? Oh, yes, she said. The pastor would be very happy to meet you. The pastor is busy right now, but if you would come. And so we followed her into what turned out to be the anteroom to the church, which was a simple structure with handmade wooden benches that filled the space on a concrete slab, into the anteroom, which turned out to be a clinic for healing. And there was a man stretched out on the table, and there was an acupuncturist who was standing there administering acupuncture, and he had these sticks sticking out in all of these different places, and I was absolutely fascinated. I had never seen this, and to come on it in this setting, and only gradually did I realize that the person who was performing the acupuncture was the pastor of the church, that this was the way the pastor of the church served the community, was by running this little clinic for health and for healing, and that the pastor was a woman. And she said just a moment, and she finished up with what she was doing, and she stood and embraced me in the love of Christ. And I knew that my communist hosts were waiting impatiently back at the road, away from this church that they didn't want to acknowledge was there. And so we walked in. She told me a little bit of the history of the church. She pointed me to the banner that hung up behind the church and said, that's John 3:16 in Chinese characters there. God so loved the world that he gave his only son. And then we held hands, and we prayed together. And I will confess that as I held hands with the deacon and with the pastor, the tears rolled down my face, and I was embarrassed, and I thought, this is why I hate holding hands when people make you do this, because you can't wipe away the tears. They just have to be there. And when the amen was said, and each one in the circle had prayed, and we let go of hands, I looked into the face of the pastor, and the tears were running down her face as well. And she said to me through the translator, "We have been praying in this village for more than 18 years that an outsider would come who was a Christian and we could share the fellowship of Jesus together. And you, today, are the answer to that 18 years of prayer. I know we will never see you again until we get to heaven. But go in the love and the peace of God." And we hugged, and we walked out and through the little village and down the path and over the creek and through the rice paddies back into the Jeep, heading for the provincial capital. Why do I tell you that story? One, it's a wonderful story. But two, think of it in terms of an extreme way of posing the question, how are we to be Christians in a culture and society that is not? How are we to be Christians? Now, in that society, you could answer that question in several ways, but one was the courage of building and going to church. That took courage. People all over China, even today, are being arrested and tortured still for their faith. So that simple act was an act of being a Christian in an intolerant, pluralistic, Marxist state. But there were other pieces in it. One was to find a way to serve the community. Was very evident there. The church wasn't accepted as a church. It was accepted in that community as a place of hope and of help and of healing, that wasn't ashamed to be the church of the poor and for the poor, serving in that place. And I thought, as I left and as I had hours on the road to ponder that experience, there's something to be learned there about what spirituality looks like in a culture, in a world, in a society where Christians are not dominant. What I want to suggest to us is that as Americans living in this society, that more perhaps than we know, certainly more than we often realize, that we are living our lives and will increasingly live our lives in the midst of a more and more pluralistic and diverse society. Ethnically pluralistic. I have lived large chunks of my life in the state of California. The state of California, in some parts of it and soon to be in the state as a whole, Anglos will find themselves in a minority in the state of California. As you look at the migrations of people and as the explosions of populations vary among different kinds of groups, more and more in many, many places in this society we find ourselves ethnically diverse, racially diverse, and culturally diverse, where the values that for some of us are as close as breathing, the values that we simply assume are there for everybody and should be there for everybody, those values are increasingly up for grabs. And we live in the kind of culture where we see the statistics, for instance, of births out of wedlock, and realize that by the end of the decade, they are saying that 40% of all white births will be outside of wedlock. You go to any major city in this country, and I have a prominent friend who's the head of a hospital, a children's hospital in Philadelphia, the head of the trauma clinic in that hospital, a pediatric surgeon, and he tells me what I've seen other places, the greatest cause of death, the highest incident of death in the city of Philadelphia is violence against children and teenagers. And you've seen the stories. You've felt the screaming headlines. The shifts in the culture that in some way are like deep earthquakes that are hard to fully comprehend and take in what the implications of that cultural diversity is. And then the religious diversity that's more and more a part of American culture. Wheaton, the center of some forms of American Christianity, with a mosque right down the street. The Hindu temple that got built not very long ago in one major city. The Mormon tabernacle that's on the freeway in town after town after town. We are more and more a religiously diverse society. Let me just mention a couple of overall responses to that. The first is the fervent embrace on the part of some in the recognition of this pluralism of what I choose to call an absolute relativism. And what do I mean by an absolute relativism? It is relativism taken to the principle of an absolute, which says there are no absolutes. There is nothing that can be used to distinguish one truth from another. In fact, in parts of this movement of absolute relativism, you have the slogan that is used, there is no truth, there is only power. And so the issue is who has the power, gets to control or declare what the truth is. In my view, an extremely dangerous response to the reality of pluralism. The issue of whether you can have respect for diversity without going all the way to the kind of relativism which dissolves all truth into some feeling-oriented, sensory-oriented, or live and let live, laissez-faire kind of thing. Robert Bella and colleagues wrote a book called Habits of the Heart and talked about a phenomena that they labeled as Sheilaism. And Sheila basically worships Sheila. And that's all right if other people worship other things as long as she gets to do her thing, of which she is at the absolute center. Another response is what I labeled nostalgic triumphalism. Nostalgic triumphalism. This is a response to the diversity which basically longs deeply for the good old days. Now, depending on who you are and where you are from, how you define the good old days differs with a lot of variation in it. But sometimes the slogans there are the good old days, which become then a code words for conservative Protestant domination of the institutions and culture of America. And that's the good old days, when we had the predominance, when you didn't have to think about what was going on in the schools, because what was going on in the schools was basically centered in the good people who had control of the schools, who shared the same values that we share. And one of the things that's hard sometimes to really grasp is the meaning of the fact that we live in a post-Constantinian society, a post-Constantinian society, and we have had that existence for several hundred years. And the nostalgia for that kind of triumphalism ignores the evidence all around us of what is actually happening. There's a third reality, and it's what I have labeled, I hope non-pejoratively, as remnant cultures. Remnant cultures. where we try to preserve pockets of piety. Example of this was I was visiting and speaking in a Mennonite Brethren church in Kansas. The Mennonite Brethren are Peace Tradition Anabaptists, a wonderful people, and I was sitting in the little eating area of the kitchen with a leading denominational figure in that denomination as he told me about how they were a set-apart culture, that the way in which they were trying to preserve their faith and their traditions was that their children went to their schools, that they went to their colleges, and that they kept them, quote, uncontaminated from the godless secular world around. And he's telling me with great sincerity, which I respect, and quite a bit of passion about the Mennonite Brethren vision, but he has his back to what I am looking at as he is talking to me, because what I'm looking at is his 3-year-old daughter who is watching Saturday morning cartoons. And I thought to myself, ah, the snake is in the house. And that whether he knew it or not, that impact of the larger society around, he could not create, no matter how hard he tried, and I live very close to Amish country, impermeable barriers to the larger trends and the influences that are out there. That these influences creep in and often threaten to and sometimes actually overwhelm the traditional convictions that for many of us as Christians we would share. Sometimes this is economic pressures. When you look at the change in family life across the culture and just focus on one reality of the two-income family and think the extent to which, if you give a poll, people will not want that to be their reality. Some do and value it, but many who do not particularly value it and find themselves in those circumstances anyway, to make a house payment, to do a number of other things that are necessary to cover some of the insecurity in terms of financial and economic forces, the force of media, etc. The reality is that we live in an increasingly pluralistic and diverse society where we do not enjoy any longer, or if we ever did in all actuality, the total control of what's going on in the world around us. How shall we respond to that? I want to mention 3 patterns of response. First, the way of power. The way of power. And this response is a response that says that I will respond to the changes, the diversity, the pluralism in the world around me by attempting to gain or regain control of that society. Many times the language that goes with this is the language of us versus them. And you can see different kinds of power conflict set up. A friend of mine, James Davison Hunter, a sociologist at the University of Virginia, was one of the first to use and then put in the title of a book, Culture Wars. And it's interesting to see the way in which the language of warfare has permeated so much of the discussion as we have talked about the response to the diversity and the changes that are there. There's a way of declaring war. And if you know you're in a war, then what you do is try and find the weapons that will enable you to do what? To win the war. And so winning and war and power become very pervasive and powerful ways of thinking about what's going on. And the tendency very often with this, there are very positive parts of this, there are very appropriate parts of this, there are very necessary parts of this, but sometimes there are some elements in choosing the way of power which raise some major issues. One is the temptation to believe that the line between good and evil is between us and them. All virtue on our side, all evil on their side. whatever that is, and then to demonize the other. World Vision is deeply involved today in Rwanda. And one of the shocking things to discover in Rwanda, where between 500,000, let that sink in, 500,000 to 1 million people were slaughtered, most of them with machetes, in a country that is 90% Christian. Pastors, elders, all caught up in a bloodbath of violence, often in the name of Jesus. One extreme negative form of the way of power. We are blessed to live in a country that, even with all of its problems, where access to power and influence can be gained by at least some by hard work, by the application of the political process, and by the use of democratic principles. But there are real temptations in seeking to use power as the only vehicle or the predominant vehicle to gain domination. And one is the seductive nature of power, where we get a fatal confusion of means and ends. And I think we can see some signs of sowing some seeds of hatred in our culture even today, which I think have the potential to bear very bitter fruit. The goal becomes winning, and winning as a good end becomes then susceptible to using any means in order to achieve that greater good. And this fatal confusion of means and ends is one of the temptations of the road to power. When you look at Jesus and the temptation as you see it expressed in Luke 4 and in Matthew, one of the things that you discover when you study that temptation is that one of the temptations at the heart of that temptation is to seize power, control over people, win their acclaim, and achieve the goals you want by choosing a means which are contrary to what God has intended. And Jesus was not seduced, but very often we are tempted to be. And one of the things in the political process searching for power is the distortion that money makes in this whole process. And I've thought of it as I have interacted with friends for whom salvation is going to come through the political process, that it's interesting to see some of them. I'm stereotyping and being not totally fair, but some of them have said something similar to me, the way in which, in order to gain power, they become oriented to money, much like a heliotropic flower becomes oriented to the sun. They just follow it around, so much so that a number have said, I don't want to do this anymore, because this isn't what I had in mind when I started out to exercise influence. To demonize, to tribalize, to sow the seeds of hatred is the shadow seduction of choosing the way of power. The second way that I see many Christians taking is the way of disengagement, the way of disengagement. Now, here I have to speak some from my own context, and this has been a changing reality. What we found at the early, middle, end of the 19th century was Christians active in a number of different kinds of moral causes, other kinds of social well-being causes throughout the country in a lot of different and creative kinds of forms. For many, many people, however, in this century, we have heard phrases for long kinds of years which have said that the Christian and politics are not to coexist. And some of the dualism here that I'm talking about in terms of disengagement, in an oversimplistic kind of way, goes from the separation of church and state, which is built in to our political system, into a dualism between the private and the public, which gets expressed, for instance, in things like a traditional doctrine on the spirituality of the church, which says the church is not to be involved in politics, which hypothesis can be defended and can be discussed, but then results in a kind of dualism which says that my Christian faith and the expression of my Christian faith has no legitimate place in the public square. And then you get what Richard John Neuhaus has called the naked public square, where the decisions about the shaping the fabric of our society tend to be assumed to have to be made within a context which says I cannot put explicit Christian values and explicit Christian motivation and explicit Christian content on the table because it's not allowed. It's not appropriate. And you will listen to Christians in politics, Christians in business, Christian in dealing with all kinds of things, trying to make the case off of purely secular rationales. And sometimes finding that when they get on that ground to make the case is not as strong and pervasive as if they told the truth, that I wish to be committed or believe we need to do this or need to see this kind of change in our society because A, God made every human person in God's image and they are people that God created and they have a certain inherent dignity that they are due by virtue of that creation. And we find ourselves in conversations that get very complicated about affirmative action and multiculturalism and all kinds of things because we cannot talk the language of Zion in the naked public square. And things get distorted and things are unsaid and the Christian voice is very often missing in this pattern of disengagement. This is very different than going to war. This is simply saying a pox on both your houses, because what I'm going to do is what Faith Popcorn, that noted sociologist and commentator on American social life, said was the name for the decade of the 90s. Do you know that name? It is cocooning. Cocooning. What is cocooning? Cocooning says that the world may be going to hell in a handbasket, the society may be having all these stresses and strains, but I'm going to come home into my nice house in the suburbs, and I'm going to make that as nice as I can be, even if it means I have to put a lot of locks on the door, and I'm going to have my VCR, and in the stereotype, I'm going to have my hot tub, and I'm going to have my large screen TV, the larger the better, and I'm going to enjoy the good life for me and for mine. And this form of disengagement, then, which basically renders Christians ineffectual, disengaged, uninvolved, but somehow feeling virtuous, as if this were the right thing to be doing. Let me just talk about one other form of that. I think for many, many Christians in America, we have what I call spiritual schizophrenia. Probably nobody in Chattanooga has this. But where I live, this is quite common, and I find it in the students on our campus as the prevailing norm. And that is something like this, that it's possible in this spiritual schizophrenia to believe that what is most significant is that I've got a saving relationship with Christ. I've got Jesus in my heart. I can sing and mean it. I come to the garden alone while the dew is still on the roses, and he walks with me, and he talks with me, and he tells me that I am his own. And so the personal then becomes the private, and it's extremely important, but it's interior. And in polite society, you're not supposed to be a fanatic. And so kind of you do a scale of Christianity, those who are polite about it and those who are more fanatical about it. But it's me and Jesus. And if that's right, all is right. So Jesus has my heart, but the world has everything else. So you do the surveys. You do them on Christian campuses. You do them on secular campuses. What is it young people want out of college? Doesn't much matter, though. There are some differences, but not as much as you would think. On the national surveys done on this, and then the samples that look to specifically Christian young people, what do they want out of college? They want a major that will result in a good job, which will result in being able to consume, to have the good life. And what is the good life? The good life is the life of consumption. There's an engagement, disengagement going on because the values there are the values of status, affluence, climbing the ladder. You've known the studies that have been done on this at Yale. Pervasive metaphor for American society is climbing the ladder. What is the path of life? Whereas Christians deeply embedded in Scripture would understand something about deliverance from bondage that God does in a mighty act of deliverance, and life as a pilgrim and a stranger and as alien. And oh no, we want to move right on to promised land. And the issue is find a ladder and climb it in order to attain. What is that? It's spiritual schizophrenia. Jesus in my heart, but the world has its own rules. And sometimes the language that's used is get real. We're talking about the real world here. And the real world, power, money, status, those are the important things. And you can put a little religious rhetoric on the top of that. But in my business, it's dog eat dog. In my firm, these are the principles and rules that we have to live with. And one of the interesting discussions I've been having lately with some rather successful middle-aged men, one of them coined a phrase. He said, "Now I've learned about success, I think I'm ready to learn about significance." Moving from success to significance. And part of what he's wanting to do is move out of the spiritual schizophrenia, which relegates Jesus to a private chaplain, rather than exalting Christ as the Lord of the world and the Lord of the universe. And in a way, when Jesus turns in to your chaplain only, and the purpose of Jesus in life is to minister to our needs, we have perverted the great confession of the church. What is the chief end of man? To glorify God and enjoy him forever. And now the touchstone for religious warmth is whether or not God is glorifying me and says that which is acceptable to my self-image and my need for self-fulfillment. The road of disengagement has many different shapes, many different evasions, many different excuses. But I doubt that for most of us, if for any of us, it is the road that God has called us to. Well, naturally, as a preacher and a professor, I have three suggestions. The way of power, with its mixed realities and its seductive temptations. The way of disengagement or withdrawal or spiritual schizophrenia. And what I suggest is that what we are called to, rather than either of those two alternatives, in the blatant way I have expressed them, is the way of courageous servanthood. The way of courageous servanthood. Engagement, not disengagement, the way of Jesus. All day today in conversations, I found myself telling the story of the same biblical passage. You will remember it. John the Baptist, who had proclaimed the way of the Lord and had his own expectations about what the Messiah, the promised one, the anointed one of God, was supposed to do when he finally came. And what he was supposed to do was to take the way of power. And Jesus didn't do it. Well, the other way was the way of the Essenes, the little group that withdrew to the desert above Jericho and totally withdrew from the society around them. And Jesus didn't do it. And so John sends the messengers to Jesus and said, "Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?" A confession of confusion. That Jesus didn't fit the expectations, didn't work within the boundaries or the scenarios that John was expecting. And instead, Jesus said to John's followers, "Go and tell John what you see. The lame are healed, the hungry are fed, the prisoners are freed, the poor have good news preached to them. And blessed is the one who does not take offense." The offense of the reality of the wholeness of the love of Christ as it's expressed in the middle of human society. Neither the way of power nor the way of withdrawal, but the way of entering into the lived stuff, the everydayness, the pain and the joys, the sorrows and the sufferings, the blind spots, and the clear, for just a moment at a time, cry of the human heart, "Lord, don't you care? Is God apart? Is he withdrawn? Is God the God only of coercive power? Or is he the God that we see most clearly in the face of Jesus?" 2 Corinthians 4 says, "The God who said, 'Let the light shine out of darkness,' is the one who shines in the face of Jesus Christ, bringing about the new creation in the human heart and the human family. The outcast, the marginalized, the children that nobody cared much about except their mothers, the racially suspect, the Samaritans whose theology was wrong, the Syrophoenician woman who said, 'Lord, even the dogs eat the crumbs from the table,' all of the categories of comfort broken through in a courageous self-emptying, which I believe is the path of spirituality in the public arena that is called for today. Not the seeking of power for its own ends, one of the most seductive sentences I've ever heard, and you've heard it, and sometimes we've said it and been tempted to believe it, that when I gain power, then things will be right. I've never forgotten the man I used to date in college who said that when I make my first million, then I can follow the way of Jesus. I can sacrifice, I can give, I can be a servant. But first I need to make that first million, and now we're in our 50s, and he's still chasing it, and he hasn't yet, as near as I can tell, become a sacrificing servant, giving himself away in humility, using the gifts that God has given him with strength and energy and determination for the well-being of the human family, for the outreach of the gospel to the ends of the earth. No, he's still chasing and chasing and chasing. The way of Jesus. In 2 Corinthians 4, again, Paul says, "For we preach not ourselves." Our faith is not Sheilaism, where what we're really doing is looking for a God to prop up our own plans, our own climbs, our own agendas, our own self-fulfillment. We preach not ourselves. Every day we learn again, if we try hard, that even in the trying, we are not the Messiah. We are not the ones who will save the world. But that does not then allow us to say, well, what can one person do? And give it all up to cocoon. Paul said, for we preach not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. I have a friend who was a socialite who'd been married 3 times at the time that she became a Christian. Her family tree was one of the most fascinating to trace that you could ever imagine, because all the children had married and remarried and remarried, and the grandchildren had married and remarried. And when she sat down to do up a list for Christmas, it needed a computer in order to do the chart, to lay it all out. And she decided that, having discovered in a fresh and new way in her life that God cared, and that Jesus had entered into her life and her heart, knowing deeply the forgiveness that had come to her and the healing that had come, she wanted to serve. And she thought of some rather grandiose ways to do that, and she's a very faithful prayer woman, and she figured out that what the Lord really wanted her to do was to help a woman that lived not very far from her who had Alzheimer's. And at that time, the Alzheimer's was too early. This woman fell between the cracks. The family didn't want to take care of her. The woman was fine sometimes, was not fine at other times. Social agencies were not willing to take her on. And my socialite friend decided that that would be her way of Jesus, her path of servanthood. A very small thing, a very unknown thing to most everybody, but she and I prayed together. And week by week, I would listen to her pray for this friend. And then I knew that she went quietly and cleaned the toilet and cleaned the woman's body and took care of her and saw that she had a good meal each day and really attempted in her own way to be a servant. One day, she came and exploded in our prayer time. I've had it. That's it. I'm never doing this again, that ungrateful person, etc. This went on for quite a while until she got it out of her system. And I said, what did she do this time? Because I'd heard some. You have too heard these stories, wandering away and different kinds of things. What did she do that was so awful, unforgivable, and difficult? And she said, can you imagine? She accused me of only coming to her house in order to steal from her. And I could tell, you know, all the other stuff hadn't gotten to her, but Adrian really felt the pang of being accused of being a thief. And she said, I'm never going back. Any person who could call me a thief doesn't deserve my caring. And then she was on quite a journey of courageous servanthood, and she stopped herself. Now, I will admit, quite a few moments had gone on before this part. And she said, oh boy, what's the matter? She said, I just realized something. I don't do this for her. I do it for Jesus. And if our service is based on whether or not people are going to be grateful, we won't do a lot of it. I can remember working in the 2-year-old room in my church. Any of you have done that? The person who recruits you says, oh, it won't take much time. We have a lot of volunteers. It's really easy. All you have to do is take this roster, and they hand you a piece of paper with a lot of names on it, and you say, you just check on Saturday night to make sure that they're going to be there for their turn on Sunday morning. And I did that for about a year and didn't go to church once, because the 2-year-old room met while church was going on. And week after week after week after week, somebody had a crisis, somebody had the cold, someone had a flu or the measles or chicken pox. And there I was in the 2-year-old room again. And the interesting thing about 2-year-olds, most of them don't say thank you. And the interesting thing about two-year-old parents is most of the time they don't say thank you. And most of the things that need to be done in the world, most of the important things that need to be done in the world, most of the places of servanthood in the world do not come accompanied by praise and thanks. And then we remember the way of Jesus was the way of the cross. The way of the cross. The kind of spirituality that we need to be Christians who make a difference in the real world is Christians who are willing to take courage and look at their circumstances and their situation and the context and the culture and the place where they're placed and say, what difference does God want to make in this place through me? I have a friend who is the head of strategic planning for a large state banking system. Next to the CEO, he was right there in the office of the president, one of the top three officers in the bank. And one day we were talking at lunch and I said, tell me, what difference does your Christian faith make in the way you plan for this bank? He leaned back, thought a minute, said, well, till just this minute, I've never thought about that. It hadn't occurred to him that God had placed him there and that there was a purpose. There was a reason. There was some discipleship that was to be lived out, not just in the privacy of his home or his heart, but in the world in which God had placed him. And that world can be a neighborhood. One of the most formative influences in my life was a woman who had a little Bible study club. We didn't have a Bible in our house, none at all. And she bribed us. Said if you'd memorize Psalm 100, the first person who memorized Psalm 100 could have a Bible. And oh, I wanted that Bible. And I memorized Psalm 100. And it laid a foundation in my life that didn't pay off for 20 years. But she laid the foundation. As Christians, we are called to be courageous servants. We're called to make a difference in the world of culture, of politics, of legal systems, of schools, of neighborhoods, of families, of churches, and of the whole world. And one of the things that I learned again in China was it's possible to be a biblical, and Christ-centered, and servant-centered Christian, even if what you do every day is acupuncture. Thank you.
Dr. Hestness will entertain questions. Mark, if you could give us maybe some lights. Thanks. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Is there anything, can you hear me? Mm-hmm. Is there anything within the monastic tradition of the Catholic Church, for example, any particular monastic order that could serve as a role model for what you are striving for in terms of being the hub of the world?
We have a lot that we can learn if we have the humility, those of us who are Protestants, to do some of that learning. I don't think that it means we need to abandon our own theologies or the benefits of our own traditions. But, for instance, I have found, let me just tell you a story. At Fuller, I taught a course for many years on spirituality and ministry, and pastors, Protestant pastors, would come from all over the country to take that course. And we were working at spiritual disciplines, not as a law to earn your salvation, but as an aid to help you make space for God in your life, in the course. And in the last week of the course, we spent 2 days in a Benedictine monastery. And we did this every year. And pastors would come to that course, and one of the things I learned to do over time was I would share the day before we went to the monastery, how are you feeling about this? And always there would be pastors that would say, my church at home is praying for me as I go into that den of iniquity in that monastic movement. And the interesting thing was, you know, they were still dealing with Luther and the devil and the Pope as Antichrist and some of that reality. And to get the Benedictines spiritual tradition is a series of worship services through the day. Work and worship are the two rhythms with the Benedictines. And the worship service is 100% the chanting or singing or praying of the Psalms. And in a week, you move through the Psalter. All 150 Psalms are prayed as you have this experience together. No preacher. And every single year, I would have pastors of small and larger churches. I remember one man who had a 7,000-member church who said, I've never been enabled to worship as much as I have worshiped these past 2 days because I was no longer bothered by trying to figure out what I felt about the pastor and how my own sermons would stack up or compare, or what I was able to focus on God. And he began then a pattern of doing a personal retreat where he went quietly to a Benedictine monastery in his area and worked with the retreat master basically to encourage his own life of prayer in that discipline. So yes, there are ways in which we can learn a great deal from the history of the church. That's our history too. Let me just mention one other resource that I personally find very helpful. And that is a man who's he's from Holland, and a wonderful spiritual resource some of you will know, Henry Nouwen. And the writings of Henry Nouwen has served for many Protestants and Catholics as a significant spiritual resource for them over the last decade and a half or so. And I personally have been quite helped by those writings. But as I've said, my own personal theology is reformed, and I don't find, I believe in that theology, and I'm not about to become a Catholic, but there are lots of resources there that I think if we've got the humility, we can benefit from. Other questions? Comments? Okay. If I understand the question, I've been asked if I'd comment on that, the fear that many of us have that if we are sharing our faith, or if we were to share our faith in a more open kind of way, that we would be intruding on other people's privacy, and we'd be engaging in a behavior that's inappropriate in our culture. One, my own sense is that it is highly appropriate to be respectful of people's privacies and not to intrude where you are clearly not welcomed. But I'll tell you a story. The banker's wife that I told you the banker about? Well, the banker's wife was involved with me in a small group training program, and as part of that, when we got done, each of the 12 people in it had to go out and invite their neighbors that they prayed about and chose to invite to come to a neighborhood discussion Bible study. And Joanne said, not my neighbors. They're all upper middle class people. They would be offended if I just even said God out loud in public. They'd all wither and die. or they'd think I was some kind of weird fanatic. And so could I just team up with somebody else, and I'll support them when they go ask their neighbors? And so it was a violation of our understanding, but we didn't want to force anybody to do anything. They were uncomfortable, and she was clearly uncomfortable. So she was with another woman, and the other woman's friends did respond and come, as did the friends of every other of the women in the groups. And Joanne was the only one who hadn't done it. The group went well. There was a good dialogue, very positive response, nothing coercive about inviting people to come to your house in the morning for coffee. And we spend some time opening the scriptures together, and we're trying to learn how to pray together in a world as crazy and mixed up as this, and we care about our kids and the good influences in their lives, etc. Would you like to come for coffee and the Bible? And the study went quite well. About 9 months into it, Joanne, we reconvened the group for kind of a party to celebrate all that had happened, and everybody told their stories, and Joanne was very quiet, and she finally said, "I give up." And the group kind of knew what she meant. And "What do you mean, Joanne, you give up?" She says, "I'll ask my neighbors." She says, "You pray for me, I'll ask my neighbors, but I'm telling you right now, not one of them will be interested." So we all prayed, and she rehearsed what she was going to say. And then she picked a time when she was positive none of her neighbors would be home. Thought that was the safest way to go. And so she goes out, and she goes by herself, and she had a little speech that she'd written down on a card that she could kind of review between houses. And she went around the kind of this cul-de-sac of their house. And in the Lord's timing, there were 12 homes, and 11 women were home. She was shocked. And of the 11 women, 11 women said yes. Now, that's extraordinary. I think God was sending her a very special message. And she started that Bible study. And when it is done in a way in which you are respectful of the other person, when you are appropriate in the way in which you seek to reach out, so often the image we have is a buttonholing, disrespect, inappropriate conversation. And that's not helpful. That's not what we're talking about. But timidity, we better name it. We're cowards. And we need to pray for courage. And then we need to realize that we do have some instructions, which are to go. Then that includes our own neighborhood and our own family members. I found people afraid to talk to their children, for fear that they couldn't handle it when their children told them the truth. They would rather live with an illusion than have a conversation about Jesus with their own children. And that's why I use the phrase courageous servanthood. I think it takes courage to move out of your comfort zone and risk in an appropriate, sensitive way. Saying a word. And you never know. Sometimes you say that word or that phrase, and somebody bites on the hook, and then they do ask you the question to which Jesus is the appropriate answer. And that's exciting. Yes. Yes. Probably not. I think probably at this hour, with this audience under this setting, that I couldn't possibly do that in less than quite a long statement, which I don't think would be all that helpful, and I don't know that I could do it very well anyway. So, good question. I think I won't respond to it. Any others you want to try? Thank you. I think that's a very pertinent question. The other one was too, by the way. It's just too big. The only answers I know to how do you walk a wise road, neither consumed by the lust for power or disengaged and withdrawn when we're supposed to be in the middle of the arena, is I think that we have to be in an intentional Christian community that takes the journey inward and the journey outward seriously and will, through praise and worship and prayer and honesty, help each other to be faithful in the midst. And one form that I have seen that take with people in business and in politics and in lots of other arenas of life is to be in a small covenant group, which is a group that is, my label for them is an accountability group, an accountability covenant group, where we give each other permission to ask about the real journey of our lives. How are you and God getting along? How is your prayer life? Where's the point of obedience that you believe God is calling you to? And are you doing that? Now, this is not an intrusive, self-appointed, I'm going to tell you how you're supposed to live your life. I don't think that's what Scripture talks about. I'm not talking about the road of legalism or intrusion, but I am saying sitting in the company of the committed, a group of people who are committed enough to each other to give each other permission, as trust is earned through confidentiality over time, to ask the question of how is it really going? I'll give you a story. I'm in a covenant group that has been meeting 1 week a year. It's a national group for over 20 years, and one of the covenant brothers told this story. He is an author on books about marriage and a pastor. He is not in Chattanooga. He was looking forward to his wedding anniversary. I think it was the 30th, maybe even 35th. With great anticipation, he made a reservation at the most expensive restaurant in town, took his wife to the restaurant. He was sitting looking at her across the table and thinking of how much he loved her and how all these years and just nostalgia and romantic and all those good feelings. And then it dawned on him that she hadn't said anything in quite a long time. And so he said, "Honey, anything the matter?" And she said, "I don't know if I can stay married to you." He was devastated. And he immediately confessed to the covenant group. He said his first thought was, "But nobody will buy my books." And then he was so ashamed that that had been his first response, you know, and here's his wife. And he's so overwhelmed by it, he can't respond. And so he didn't. And he said something like, "Oh, huh?" You know, and then said, "Nice view," or, you know, "How do you like the iced tea," or something. And made chit-chat the rest of the conversation, and the mood at home was definitely frosty. But he was afraid to pursue the conversation because he really had heard her as saying, 35 years and it's over. And he didn't want to hear the rest of it. He couldn't think of why. What had he done? How did he miss it so badly? But nonetheless. So, week goes by. He goes to his covenant group. And after the whole thing was over, he said, "Oh, I suppose I'd tell you the truth." He'd told him something about something where he looked good. And he said, I need to tell you about my anniversary dinner." And the group said, "What do you think you ought to do about it?" That's an accountability question. What do you think you ought to do about it? He said, "Well, I ought to talk to my wife." And the group said, "Yes, we think so too." So he goes home, and well, now they're back on the ordinary plane of life, and he can't find a good occasion to bring it up. You know, just why would you bring up anything that unhappy? And so they just go through the polite chit-chat. 2 weeks later, he goes back to his covenant group, and they said, how'd the thing go with your wife? Oh, well, we've been busy, you know. And so the group says, okay, that's it. Next time, you know, we want a detailed report. So he said, and then they all prayed by name that he would do the right thing, talk to his wife. So he, as he was telling this story in our National Covenant group, he said, I knew I couldn't come back to that group another time. So I had a choice. I could either drop out of the group or I could talk to my wife. So he said, just to get him off my back, I talked to my wife. I said, honey, you remember that night? Oh, yes, I remember. And he said, well, I think we ought to talk about this. She says, I've been waiting every day for you to talk about this. And then the conversation went on, and she said she'd been feeling left out of his life. He'd been so busy. And he was taking his day off to play golf. And she was wondering and fishing by saying, I don't know about staying married. She wanted him to come back and say, oh, I couldn't imagine life without you. And she said, when you didn't respond, then I began thinking, there really is something wrong here. And he said, as he was sharing the story, he was saying how the romance was rekindled and the marriage was going on with a new sense of joy and delight in it. He said, I'm such a jerk, but I'm grateful to God for my covenant group because they helped me to do what I knew I should do anyway, but I needed that outside push. Well, I feel that way about our work as teachers in classrooms, as parents with our children, in our responsibilities, in our work. You know, sometimes what we need is a group to whom we give permission to ask the question, how are you doing? What do you think God wants you to do? How could we help you to do, to be faithful, to be obedient to the call of God in your life? And a group like that can make an enormous difference in helping us both avoid the distortions of power. I know covenant groups like this among men and women who have enormous power. And the group helps. In fact, there's one group in Pittsburgh. I've got three men in that group on my board at Eastern. And they will tell the story. These are men who have been the top men in large multinational corporations. And they will tell the story of how being in that group has helped them to think Christianly about their work. It's not about carrying a Bible on the job. It's asking, what does the decision about the plant in Brazil mean for the people who will be in the catchment area of that plant, for the environment, for the impact of the decisions that we will make in place? He said, I never used to ask those questions that way. I'd ask, what was the dollar impact? He said, I'm now asking, what's the people impact as well as the dollar impact? He says, I think that's because of my covenant group. So that's one of the ways.